You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 147 for October 10th, 2018. I'm your host for today, Stephen Wagner. On today's show, we talk with Sarah Herr about synthesis in CRM. We also welcome Bill Ochter in his first appearance as a regular co-host. So grab your DX7 because our CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is our new co-host, East Coast Bill in Maryland.
Hello. Hi there.
And special guest is Sarah Herr in Tucson, Arizona.
Hey, hi.
We're going to talk with Sarah about synthesis, but first we thought we'd introduce or reintroduce Bill. He's been a regular guest or semi-regular guest, and he's kind of finally signed on as a permanent co-host. Bill, do you want to refresh everybody about who you are and what you do?
Okay, so I've been a professional archaeologist now for about 10 years. When I first came on my first episode, I was heavily concentrated in the world of telecommunications and the archaeology used to support the building of cell towers and other types of devices. Now I've moved on. I'm a field supervisor now with a larger architectural and environment and engineering firm working out of their DC office. And I'm a professional archaeologist, so I'm sort of working different projects. My general interests are going to be on sort of the areas around the Chesapeake Bay and sort of the colonial period, specifically like the antebellum period. And as sort of a side gig, I'm sort of engaging in, I guess, what would be called experimental archaeogaming, trying to put together sort of a tabletop role-playing game with archaeologists about archaeology. But that's a sort of a side thing. My main thing is just boring, good old-fashioned CRM work.
It should be pointed out that you were originally one of our super fans. You were the only person to come to our live podcast recording at the SAAs in Vancouver.
yeah, that was a weird
It was an exciting time.
I knew who was going to be called on from the audience in that time.
Yeah, it was great to have a smiling face in the audience. The topic for today, we are going to talk to Sarah Herr about synthesis in CRM archaeology. She had done a survey of CRM archaeologists and presented a paper on it at the EAAs. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Sarah?
Sure. So if you don't mind, I'm going to back up a little bit. And there's a newly formed coalition for archaeological synthesis that we might talk more about a little bit later. And sure, they wanted to do their first European show of what this coalition was about. It's just brand new. They want to bring in some European audiences. So they were going to put on a session at the Barcelona meetings this year. And I was one of the people identified to speak up for cultural resource management in this format. But that's somewhat of a heavy burden to be the person to speak for cultural resource management. It's such a huge field. There's such diversity of thought across the country. And so I was a bit intimidated. So I put out a survey on Twitter. And I don't have such a big, huge Twitter following. So some people noticed it, and I was very grateful. And then some people answered the survey. And then I also just did a lot of email and some arm twisting to get the participants I got on this. And in the end, I got 17 participants, which isn't a huge sample size, of course, but they represented a wide range of companies across the country. And yeah, the goal was to sort of get a feeling for how do CRM archaeologists feel about archaeological synthesis? How do they define synthesis? And how do they imagine themselves or their companies participating in archaeological synthesis?
Sure. So what do they think about synthesis? Let's just start right there.
Well, so it was interesting. So I think the goal of the coalition is like they're thinking about synthesis in these, you know, super grandiose ways of like, how does archaeology speak to climate change? How does archaeology speak to, you know, global patterns of migration? I think what I mean, I know this because I'm in CRM every day of my life as well. But I think CRM archaeologists are intensely pragmatic. And so for us, at least the folks who responded to the survey, synthesis is much more place-based for us. It's regional. It's and a lot of people brought up the products that our state historic preservation offices support, the context studies. And they just wanted to see, you know, really well-developed regional questions and summaries and like help everybody catch up. I don't know about how states around the country are doing their context studies, but I feel like maybe there have been some lapses in keeping those things up to date. And so that was what people really focused on, is their definition of synthesis, was just kind of writing these big, having these good supporting documents that would help them write their research questions.
But you're thinking that there's like a different definition? Because I have to say, I'm one of the 17 people who filled out the survey. And in my mind, I think a lot in terms of historic context, because I find them to be like incredibly useful tools when I'm dealing with like a theme or a property type that I'm not too familiar with.
Right. Yeah. So I think that is the tool of our profession. But the other version of synthesis, which may be perhaps a more academic definition of synthesis, and I think maybe what was is the focus, or maybe the possible focus of this this incipient coalition, is trying to put together stuff that's not put together information that's not regional, that's not place-based, and it speaks to like kind of a higher level of like process-based thinking, I guess. And so, like I said, I think there's people hold up like some of the great National Park Service programs and looking at using archaeological data to look at climate change, for example. And I'm not sure that kind of study shows up as much in context studies. So they're looking for big, like, what can affect policy? You know, what parts of CRM data can affect policy across the country? Can we use our data to talk to lawmakers about something? Yeah, I can't quite think of what all the huge synthesis. I often think of the human migration stories as part of that that big picture look at synthesis as well. So yeah, I think there are multiple definitions of synthesis, and that was one of the big, I think, revelations for me in the survey is how different those are for people, and whether these two groups will be able to speak to each other.
Yeah, when I was reading the article, I was sort of, at least in my mind, I was thinking in terms of like things like sort of like when you hear like meta-analysis studies, you're just taking sort of multiple pieces of data, putting them together, and trying to extrapolate sort of longer pieces out of it. So I guess one of my first questions, and I think this was sort of like even addressed by some of the people in a survey, are things like the quality or even just the standards being used. We see a lot in CRM, the data is not always consistent from report, from state to state, or even from project type to project type. So like, you know, like what type of tools might be out there to sort of like understand, like if you're trying to use the data of a region to sort of look for climate change, what type of data would you actually be looking for to pull out in order to do something like that?
I think the other big reveal for me was exactly the comment about is data ready for synthesis? So another aspect of this coalition is that they talk about how you know, CRM has been a profession in the United States for now 52 years, and so there should be 52 years of data that we all have. And so I think in my imagination, I had imagined this great Fort Knox of usable data. There was just piles of things in you know, I don't know, database files that we could use and draw on, and that's not. That became very, very clearly not the case as people described how their companies and how they personally you know, use the data in what has become very project-based archaeology. And so I think you're absolutely right that there is no consistent standard. I mean, how many of us are told you know, exactly what you know, people are looking from our pollen analysis, or whether we should be using, you know, tiny little shellfish to measure environment and climate change? I don't think very many of our clients are asking for that kind of stuff. So it's so widely variable, but variable between reports. The data, I think everybody who answered this survey recognizes that there's going to be a real problem of compiling data that talks to each other, and some concerns about, well, does the lowest common denominator types of categories that you could unify data with, are those going to be what provides you a synthesis? I mean, the patterns will have to be so abundantly and bluntly strong to use that lowest common denominator type of analysis that will it perform as people hope with these big visionary challenges, I guess.
So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the problems is sort of this data was never collected with the intention of sort of having a meta-analysis conducted with it. And I think another thing I really saw on that, and maybe talk a little bit now, might even go over to another segment, is the idea of, especially in CRM, is the matter of who's paying for this. Typically with CRM, it's very focused on the project, on the deliverable, mm-hmm. on the report. So we don't, part of the challenge, I think, with a synthesis out of this, and like I said, I think your folks in your survey were definitely pointing this out, is we aren't creating the data that's easily transferable. We're not looking to do it in that manner and so forth. So was there anything really that sort of popped out as far as like maybe an avenue to try to help to turn this corner and to make, have to start making the data that's generated by CRM more usable on a sort of a synthesis platform?
Yeah, well, I guess, possibly two thoughts. One is that maybe that is a role for this coalition for synthesis, is that it can become a place for a conversation that says these are the kinds of data that I think really help move some arguments forward. Because, I'm sure that each one of us who is out there in the field and working with our data sets in the office wants our data to be usable. I mean, we're all expecting it to be usable beyond the project, and we're all talking about long-term curation of our information. But we kind of just toss it out there. We're doing our best guess. So if there's something that, I think if there's some guidance that says, you don't have to collect everything, but collect this, it's probably both good for our sampling and for our analysis and making making the information that we do project by project more relevant. So I don't know that there's an easy answer, but I think that there would be an interesting conversation about what data moves forward, the kinds of questions I think we want to be asking as a profession and that we think we can assist with in this big picture thinking.
Well, that's really interesting, because that was kind of my response to the Grand Challenges article, and that you do mention it in your presentation. That when I read that, when it first came out, and I read it, and it's like, here are all the themes that we can discuss and blah blah blah, and it's like, well, that's great, but like, what data do I need to be recording to do this? Like it's all very theoretical, and it's not drifting down towards like the methodical, right? Like it's not really asking it's like, I don't know anything about like some of these topics. And if you want to use my data for that, great, but I'm probably not recording the right data.
And I think that's one of the reasons CRM folks really haven't necessarily responded well to the Grand Challenges. And I think it's one of the things that people brought up that they really like about the context studies, is that when you do context studies, people break down the questions, right? They say, these are the site types. These are they do the middle range theory relationship between the question and the data. And so the Grand Challenges needs to be broken down into hey, Midwest, you can really tell us a lot about this, or, hey, South Texas, your data is really strong in these ways. And I think if we could if there was a way to kind of, think through how the bridging of our bottom up and top down data, maybe we could be more responsive, because I think we all had that same reaction. Like, how are we going to get it past psychology? I think that's one of the questions of the Grand Challenges. And I don't really know which data I'm going to be, getting in my quarter inch screen to help with that.
but I think the context model is actually probably a good model as a possible solution. I mean, when we're looking at building context, we're often using previous summaries or sometimes we're even using historiographies of sort of past histories of a place, especially in a historical archaeological context. And a lot of those things, you know, the author of a local history written 100 years ago was not anticipating the questions that we would interrogate and use their history for in a modern context. So re-examining sort of the, you know, some of the ways we sort of already go back into the and other mm-hmm. people's datas and extract information that's useful for us today might be, and seeing what we're doing there might be useful to sort of project forward of like, what do we have in our data that can move
right
beyond that?
And I mean, I think, you know, folks know this, but the data that, you know, moves forward most easily, I think we're already seeing being used for big syntheses. So and often that tends to be the more instrumental data. So you see people doing like, you know, big aggregate studies like Bob Kelly's project with, I think, is it all the carbon 14 dates in the entire United States or maybe North America that he's putting together? Because that's easy data to pull out. And, you know, I think people do it with but also like neutron activation data and stuff. You can pull together big synthesis data as well. But for our less standard, more interpreted historical archival data, it seems a far bigger challenge right now.
Sure. We're coming up on time for our first segment. So after the break, maybe we can push that question forward to, well, who's going to do this? it might be a good time to talk about the coalition.
Okay.
So join us after the break and we'll see you then.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
And we're back. We've been joined by Doug in Scotland, who was finally able to get his recording working. Hey, Doug.
Hey, everyone.
Okay. When we left for the break, we were just about to talk about who's responsible for all of these questions and synthesis and stuff like that. Sarah had mentioned the Coalition for Archaeological Synthesis, which outside of this, the survey and her presentation, I've never heard of. So, Sarah, can we maybe start off with just discussing what this group is and who's in it?
You know, sure.
Where do they come from?
Yeah, so it's a group that probably you're all familiar with in a way. I mean, it's a few names changed, but so the Coalition for Archaeological Synthesis had its inception, perhaps, in a seminar that was held at the School of Advanced Research in Santa Fe in February of 2017. And it wasn't that this was the first time this idea had happened. The organizers were Jeff Altschul, so former SAA president, and Keith Kintig, and facilitated by Terry Klein, who runs the SRI Foundation as well. So names that probably people are really familiar with in terms of thinking of kind of big picture archaeology. And so I think they've been working towards this thought of archaeological synthesis for a while. And those are folks who are you're familiar with as authors on the Grand Challenges article that we were talking about earlier, that I think was published in American Antiquity probably around 2014. Mm-hmm. They're also the folks that were involved with the Digital Archaeological Record, TDAR, or Digital Antiquity, I think, is the nonprofit that runs that. And so they've been thinking in this big picture way and trying to think about the foundations of, about archaeological data for a number of years. I think maybe one of the little inspirations for doing this coalition thinking now, well, there's probably a couple, and some of them were probably very personal, like things like, you know, Jeff Altschul had just come off his term as the SAA president and was looking for a new visionary kind of, thing to involve himself with, as probably are, you know, Keith Kintig and these other folks. So the timing might be right for them personally, but also I think the fact that we did just celebrate 50th birthday of the National Historic Preservation Act in 2016, and there was a effort in 2016. There was a project called Making Archaeology Public that asked every state in the country to create a video that spoke to the public about what 50 years of taxpayer money had done, and provided what stories had come out of them. And I don't know, maybe 20 states responded to this, but it was a real focus on what have we contributed, where's the data, what can it do? And there was sort of a realization that we've got this data, we're great at hoarding it, and we're great at curating it. We talk about curating a lot, but archaeologists had a hard time telling the story. I mean, the fact that 50 states couldn't come up with a, 5 to 10 minute video a piece, I think, was sort of stunning for people. And so also kind of a recognition that that we need to do better in terms of telling the stories and giving back a product that's exciting. And synthesis may be part of doing that. So I think that, like, all of that combined was part of the basis for this meeting. And the idea for the coalition, so it happened in these 2 days in Santa Fe with about 12 folks that represented it was definitely Southwest archaeology dominant, because there was not much of a budget for this. But it included, a lot of professors, people who were involved with some well-known, at least Southwest, grant-funded and Mellon-funded projects that were doing synthesis. And then I think I was the spokesman for CRM. So anyway, that was my burden, was to speak for all of us. So there was folks like Barbara Mills, who has a fairly substantial National Science Foundation grant to do a synthetic project using ceramics and architecture around the Southwest. And there was Tim Kohler, who I think with a group of folks from Crow Canyon has done the Village Ecodynamics project that also, I don't know how many years that went on for, and it had two iterations, also kind of a big synthesis project. Jerry Sabloff from the... The Santa Fe Institute, also a big synthetic institution, was there as well. So anyway, that was kind of the part. There was all of those folks were in this group, as well as many others that I'm not listing. And so they thought of putting together this organization called the Coalition. They're going to look for they incorporated by the end of last year. They decided to do a couple small pilot projects as proof of concept, and then they're going to look for some grants that will support bigger projects. But the idea of the coalition was that it needed to come with shovel-ready data. And the idea was that CRM had this shovel-ready data. And so that we could be, and I think this has been the standard perception of us in CRM, is that we're the data providers. We don't always have the time and money or the structural support to provide the research. But maybe other folks take our data, or how do we participate is one of the questions that comes out of these things. But anyway, so CRM has this 50 years of data, and there's folks that are ready to use it. And so that was one part of it. So I'll stop talking for a moment and see if anyone has any comments.
Yeah, first, I should point out that Bill's in the background. Okay. West Coast Bill just joined in. Kind of brought up a really interesting point, and we briefly touched on in the first segment, but there's this quote. It's a really brilliant quote, if I can say, in your paper. And the quote is, the amount of data and sites found are often held up as an example of how we're benefiting archaeology and the academy as a whole. This is rarely ever backed up with any impact statistics that show any actual use of that data. Mm-hmm. And I particularly like that quote because it's quoting me, but beyond that, I think that my objection still stands, that the notion that we're providing shovel ready data kind of just assumes that our data is inherently useful, and we just kind of plow on accumulating more and more data, mm-hmm. Without regard to whether it is usable out of the box, or if it, does it have to be, processed? Are we recording the right things? That sort of thing.
Yeah. And so I mentioned briefly that Barbara Mills has this good National Science Foundation grant. And Bill may know more about this. I think he's probably sat in the same lab that she's been working on this data with. But I think she's trying to put together a database that will help study, the demography and the social networks And relationships across the entire Southwest. And she started from AD 1200 to, you know, 1400 and now has expanded it. And the amount of effort, and they're using gray literature for sure to put together this database, but the amount of effort that they have to go to create this database just for, you know, probably mostly Arizona and New Mexico is going into a lot of gray literature. It's reinterpreting the ceramics categories. It's assessing people's room counts for architecture. And it's, you know, creating various ontologies. And that's not, that to me doesn't seem very shovel ready. It's a very labor intensive process, and that, you know, they can do because they, you know, they've got some support for, I think early grad students to help with this, but it's incredibly labor intensive. There's not a shovel ready database that has, you know, ceramics from across Arizona and New Mexico in one place. There will be at the end of this process when she creates this master database, but it's not there now. So that's definitely a fiction that our data is ready to go. It's a data mining exercise in PDFs. You know, I assume that a lot of these reports have been turned into PDFs now in our SHPO offices or in paper archives, I think in our museums and our permitting offices.
Or more than that.
Yeah.
More than that. Like, you know, in a lot of cases, it's the, you know, we have to go back to the curated materials. And there was a conversation on Twitter that I stumbled into a few weeks ago that basically, you know, the notions of, like, you know, a lot of federal agencies do what's called field curation, where they're basically noting the artifacts in the field and leaving them out there. And you know, if we're not, the types of data that we're recording when we're doing field curation is not appropriate, then, you know, there's no going back. Like, we can't go back to the curated materials and reassess them if like we left them out there.
Yeah. And I think for the, you know, this one project I'm speaking of, they're going into the reports, but, like, I mean, I don't know that they're going into the photographic archives and all of this. I mean, you're right. It would take a really deep dive, you know, maybe even going back into the sites to get the diagnostics you need. And if your question isn't about time and space, you know, what the UTM coordinates and what the diagnostic ceramics are, you definitely are going to have to go back in.
Sure.
And I think a sort of another problem presented, like, well, while you have this project you're discussing as an example, without, like, either, like, agency or state support of that, it might just happen and fade away. But to be something continue with something moving forward, you almost need to sort of embed it in sort of either the state or agency standards for archaeological procedures within that area. That's one of the things I was thinking of with this is, you know, as a possible next step for the organization might be things to reach out to sort of state level professional CRM organizations. Because I noticed that, you know, you had a lot of participation from ACRA in your survey, and sort of the next logical step would sort of take it to this sort of different state levels, because your state professional organizations, depending on what state you're in, can actually contribute white papers to the SHPO's office, which can directly influence, if not write, the standards for conducting archaeological surveys within that state. And that's such, you can sort of dictate how and what way data is collected so that data can be usable on the back end. Rather than what you're discussing is sort of this big, huge effort of just trying to synthesize it in a manner so that you can then move it on to the next step for analysis. So you don't have to reinterpret all of our data more than once.
Yeah, and that conversation has happened a little bit recently in Arizona, not because of the coalition, but from some other sort of frustrating state legislature types of situations. But I felt like at least my colleagues in Arizona very much want, in this case, like our State Historic Preservation Office, to kind of demand us to step up a little bit more. I mean, they're not really in a position to do that, but I feel like we are sort of craving this sort of help to systematize, because, you know, it's hard to do it, you know, sort of company by company. So looking for that government or that potentially professional organization oversight, I think, is a fantastic comment.
Yeah, because it'd be really awkward and going nowhere conversation with your client of, yeah, we'd like a few extra $1,000 so that we can create a help with the synthesis of this data so it can be used by other people, which won't directly affect you or benefit you in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, just give us some extra money.
Right. Yeah, we always like it when we can actually end up with a good story that they're willing to put a few more dollars into so that they can have an exhibit in their, you know, entry hall or something like that.
Well, in Canada, the reviewers, the regulators, because we answered to the province, so the reviewers, like provincial archaeologists rather than like a SHPO per se, but they have, depending on the province, but generally they have considerably more power in dictating what they want and how they want it as far as data goes. So we have very structured requirements as far as like spatial data that we provide. So in like a Canadian setting, it would be possible for them to, you know, format, basically like, here's the types of data that we want because we're interested in these questions province-wide. The dangers in that, and you know, throw this back to Sarah, is potentially that, like, if we become too obsessed about or too focused on certain types of questions, we might start ignoring other aspects. And one of our core functions is to identify like important heritage places, right? Like, which is not on a broad. Necessarily on a broad synthesis scale.
Yeah, and I guess I have two comments. One is that it strikes me that probably a bunch of states have, or maybe all the states, I'm sure, have really good standards for survey data. It's the excavation data that I think becomes particularly problematic. I feel like there's less standards on how we report that. So there is a basic level of, you know, methodology and you know, that unifies the survey, but that's not where the sort of, you know, complete human story comes from. It often takes that, you know, deep dive into, you know, people's trash and then the nooks of their houses and things.
To add a slightly different perspective from a different country, over in the UK, they have regional research frameworks. And that's, imagine like the grand challenges only on a regional scale, similar to what we've been discussing. And that So again, slightly different terminology. Instead of having a SHPO, you have a council archaeologist. Councils, it's better to think of it as like having an archaeologist at the county level. So county level in the Western United States, where counties are quite big, as opposed to the East Coast, where counties are quite small. And so, yeah, a similar sort of, you know, fairly large counties, and you have a council archaeologist. And so when you're putting in a proposal to do the work, you would say, oh, and our program of work is going to be this, and we're going to focus on these questions in the regional research framework. And so it kind of works similar to how you guys have been describing a system. Though one issue that kind of pops up that we've discovered over here is, it's all well and good to go into a project with goals, but as we all know, once you start digging, what you find and what you thought you would find are not necessarily the same things. Right. So it is a bit interesting trying to think about how you record data to make it so you can basically have a synthesis and plug it into other people's work, especially when, you know, that decision may have to be made at like, you know, 10 in the morning on a random Thursday because you've suddenly discovered that you now have prehistoric stuff on your site. So it is tough to pull together that sort of range of data that's usable by other people, because sometimes you don't even know until you've possibly already dug it what it is that you're actually finding and how you should be recording it.
I'm gonna jump in real quick. We're kind of out of time for this segment, but when we come back after the break, give Sarah a chance to answer that.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members.
And we're back. Sarah was just about to answer Doug's question about focused data.
Yeah, and actually, I was just going to thank Doug for reminding me of what the part I forgot in my previous response was, that that of course, by us attempting to focus on folks' grand challenges, you only look at the strong data, and then strong data just keeps building on strong data. But one of the great things about, or one of the reasons that I particularly enjoy CRM work, is that we find all the small, the messy, the unexpected, because we have to, because that's what's in our project area. And that's one of the big contributions of CRM, is that we study the things that nobody else wants to because we have to. And that has to be a contribution to the human story that's being told through synthesis as well. So I appreciated his reminder of, like, well, how do you change gears if your research design is too focused on these grand challenges?
It is one of the advantages of having, say, pulling together a list of challenges, though, is you do have that list. So if you do find something new, you basically switch gears and say, well, we were hoping to answer question 16, but now it's 96. So it does work out, but it can be messy, I'd say. It's not a very clean process.
Well, and one of the things that I asked in the survey was, if it's not the grand challenges, what are the questions you think are important for synthesis? And I think CRM people would write it. There was an interesting bit of overlap. There are places where CRM archaeologists definitely see that we can answer with our data those challenges, but also identified, you know, so the Venn diagram had maybe like 30% shared or something. But then there was another 70% of questions that we thought we could answer. Maybe those we try and convince folks are also important synthesis questions. I'm trying to remember what those were, though. I think it was the questions of movement, mobility, and migration were ones that both CRM and the grand challenges thought, and the questions of human-environment interactions were ones where we thought we could speak together. Otherwise, we had more interest in landscapes and settlements than the academic synthesis folks did. I think CRM synthesis questions tend to be very place-based, because that's the way we approach our projects. This is in a very place-based way. And so we were interested in, I mean, just about everybody spoke to some kind of landscape archaeology being something that we were well-positioned to synthesize. And then things that might be more more expected, like provenance studies, we're very good at that. That's again a kind of place-based study, and looking at maybe more functional things than the grand challenges would like us to do, and look at technological change through time. Those were the kinds of big topics that I think CRM archaeologists felt like they could address.
Sarah, I know this is all very early days and whatnot, how has the sort of public or general communities been involved, or is it too early in the process to involve people sort of looking at, if we're doing synthesis, not just are we doing synthesis because it's interesting to archaeologists, but are we answering questions or trying to put together data that has sort of wider reach to different groups? And I'm kind of thinking of that project that happened. I'm totally going to butcher this, but there was that census they did of all the data on the East Coast looking at climate change and stuff like that. So obviously a very important subject, you know, climate change for a lot of different people. But for the organization stuff, has there been sort of discussions about how you start looking at what you put together, you know, in relation to the communities that are involved with this work?
I think, as you said, I think it's early days for the coalition on it. So I think they're taking inspiration from projects like that as they attempt to form the organization. Like, I'm not even sure they've had their first board of directors meeting, this coalition. They've put together a board of directors. But there's a recognition that one part of, as they create a institutional structure for this coalition, that there's going to have to be a person who's savvy with media or storytelling. And that's going to be a really critical part of, because if it's just us talking to us again, which is what all archaeologists do in the bar or by the campfire, you know, there's not going to be much reason to be doing the synthesis. So I think they're realizing that that's going to have to be a component of this, but I'm not sure that's been structured in quite yet. So I think they are trying to use this group. I had mentioned folks like Keith Kintig and Jeff Altshul at the leadership of this group. They've been very good at least getting opinion pieces into things like the proceedings of the National Academy of the Sciences, which I think they can, I think some of those are open access or free access. I think they can be widely shared. So they get it there, but I mean, into popular, more popular and widely read places that hasn't been institutionalized yet.
So, well, along those lines, for the people who are listening and really want to get involved, is it still time? Is it possible to, get in touch with this coalition, join it, or participate? Or are you still kind of trying to figure out how to get the rest of us involved? Thinking in terms of like CRM particularly, but.
Yeah, so I think right this minute is, there may not be a lot to do, although there's a website that's the Coalition for Archaeological Synthesis. It's arcsynth.org, and it tells a little bit about the organization. So what they've done is right now they're working on proof of concept. And so they put out an advertisement, I can't remember how actually, that sought two pilot studies for fairly reduced amount of money that they thought could get done in the next couple years, and I believe those were funded by the SRI Foundation because they wanted to prove this, and they found two studies. One is by Stephanie Crabtree, I think Washington State University grad, looking at archaeoecology, and another was on people and fire relationships. And that coalition had not just archaeologists, but also kind of land managers and fire managers, and looking at people and fire in, I think, the northern Midwest. So that's what's going on right now. So it's a little bit, I don't know that they're going to do any more pilot studies until these two run through. And so there's not necessarily a chance at the end of 2018, like there was maybe at the end of 2017 to put in proposals for these kinds of projects. Because I think they're hoping that these are so successful that they can then go to the National Science Foundation or the Mellon Foundation or whoever the big funding sources are that I don't know, and then make this something that's far more institutional. And then I think that'll be the time where they'll be looking for a lot more varied participation. I think it's that Northern Midwest project, I think, is the one that had more CRM data than I think that's the one that used more CRM data of the two pilot projects.
But these projects are largely focused on the synthesizer and not like data calls, or is there a part of it where whoever's running the projects are going out and doing calls to supply data?
I'm not 100% sure. I usually think of myself as about 80% correct. So,
sure.
So with that caveat, I believe that probably to do this proposal, they had to have some sense of where their data was coming from before they could be funded by it. Because the idea was that they would come with their shovel-ready data, as it was phrased, into this coalition, and then what the coalition would do would be to fund meetings where all their participants, so say maybe a dozen participants, could come together and sort of create this community of trust, talk about the data, but also be comfortable talking across disciplines and to some brainstorming in the hopes that that would reach a higher level of thinking than just an individual PI would do on their own. But I think the idea was that the data was already there, or at least easy to gather, and that they wouldn't be doing any data gathering as part of this fund, this set of funding. So no, I don't think there would be a call to CRM from the two existing projects in this at the moment. So I think that part of the model for the coalition was that I think there was a study or a play organization called like the National Ecological Analysis and Synthesis Center in Santa Barbara for a number of years, and people talk about how that ecological institute transformed the way people collected their ecological data, and the coalition was viable for 25 years. It changed the way people in their day-to-day practice collected data and worked together collaboratively, and so people saw a real sea change in ecological studies, and they're sort of hoping this coalition would do the same thing. Like it does, so now that ecological organization is closed, they feel like it did its thing, it transformed this particular type of science, and so now it's no longer necessary, and so it closed its doors, and so there's this hope that this something about this collaborative synthesis organization in archaeology will it doesn't have to be forever, but I hope that it'll transform, the fundamentals of the way CRM and academics work together. So that's the very idealized version. I think my survey paper said that there's a whole lot of pragmatics to get over before that ideal is ready to happen.
Yeah. I imagine it sounds like it's a big deal, right? And there's a certain amount of like, how do we, how do we move forward? And I mean, part of it is, coming from CRM, we're kind of like, I don't want to say territorial, but we're very territorial about our own work. And so like the notion of like this group of academics out in the Southwest coming up with like a coalition, it's going to rub certain archaeologists that we all know the wrong way. Right. Like it's like, who do they think they are telling us, what we ought to be recording sort of thing.
One of the things I liked, like I was going through the slides of the presentation, which is also very cool, was sort of this one slide highlighting the National Historic Preservation Act, especially the line and discussing that the work is in the public interest. And I think as an interesting framing tool of discussing sort of these synthesis and might overcome challenges of sort of territorialism and things like that, if we're discussing synthesis as a public service, as something in the public interest. And I guess, the question kind of would be then sort of like, what are some of the things the coalition sort of doing to sort of highlight that, or is it once again, it's part of the early stages, early framework?
Yeah, well, so in the conversation that happened that February in 2017, when we were sitting together just in the inception of this coalition, the conversation came up just like I asked CRM, what is synthesis? It came up in that room, what is synthesis? And I think there was a real divergence there in the room, because there were these folks, like these big science-oriented academic thinkers. Like I said, Santa Fe Institute was there, these folks who have big National Science Foundation and massive grants, who think about very, very well, like the grand challenges and these big policy kinds of things. On the other side of things, though, which I think was more my position, and that comes because I am out of a dirt archaeology CRM background, is that I feel like the synthesis is also the storytelling in the places we work and in the communities we work. And that some of our obligation is to think about public interest every time we go and spend taxpayer money, on the side of some road, is to think about a story that means something to the people who are right there and connects them to their landscape. And, the people that we, whose houses we find, we connect them to the people who live there today. And so I think there's maybe an argument to be made about other kinds of synthesis that are, more heritage studies. They aren't, full on science. They're more, they're local, but they're rich, and think about synthesis in terms of maybe enriching in an enriching way, and
so like a context study.
Yeah, but also trying to speak to more than archaeologists. So the context study speaks to we speak to each other through the context study, but try and try and, you know, imagine, can our work, you know, be put into signage on the street corners that helps people understand that this, you know, street has this heritage and it's, you know, been here for 300 years and it connected these places. So trying to take, you know, take that first step and then just make it connect to the people who are curious and stop by the side of the road to see us dig. So I'd like to see that kind of synthesis as well. That's intensely enriching for places and making places feel more unique and feel more special through the archaeology we do. And so I was sort of trying to invent in my own head, kind of more heritage focused synthesis. And there was other people in the room who definitely work with a lot of tribal members and who feel that obligation as well to the work they do is to provide something very, very tangible, not just synthesis that serves policy, not synthesis that serves legislation, although that's definitely needed, but also to see it in other ways too. So coming out of the context studies and with that localness to it, but then doing, trying to find a way to do more and maybe involving more people too. Like maybe the synthesis is that you just don't just talk to archaeologists, but you talk to other community members, descendant communities, and do synthesis that way as well.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if, as opposed to like the standard grand challenges in that American Antiquity article, that, you know, maybe there are broader grand challenges that, you know, essentially our audience wouldn't be interested in. You know, what do tribal members want to know? What do, you know, the general populace want to know? You know, if we're doing this for the public, what does the public want to know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like I had somebody tell me.
Preferably something we could answer.
So somebody came up and told me that, like, you know, they had family day at their archaeological site and the folks came up and they were like, you know, so did people have pets? You know, I mean, not that archaeological synthesis needs to focus there, but is that a question we've asked? You know, it's not been part of my research designs. So.
Nice. Well, thank you for joining us. We're running out of time. Anybody have any last thoughts?
Nothing that we can sum up in the next minute.
Oh, great. Maybe in a few months, as things progress, we can have Sarah back and discuss this a little bit further.
Sure. Well, it's fun because it's sort of wild and out there, and who knows whether it can actually come to fruition.
I think sometimes it's worth trying to do the hard. And if we can get halfway there, it's a lot better than we are right now.
Yep. Well, I love the provocative part of it, wherever it goes.
Well, thank you to Sarah Herr for joining us in discussing synthesis. A really interesting topic that I think we'd all like to touch on some more.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks for all the co-hosts for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Adios.
Bye. See ya.
Is Doug counting down? Not even counting down.
Bye. I think now I just wait for Bill to laugh. And that's
I'm
my
muted.
To say goodbye.
I usually mute it. I don't know why I think it's funny. So many years and I still think it's funny.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.